Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet E. Ethelbert Miller. E. Ethelbert Miller is a poet and literary activist. He is the board chair of the Institute for Policy Studies, a progressive think tank located in Washington, D.C. He is the author of more than 12 books of poetry and prose, including Fathering Words, The Making of an African-American Writer, Buddha Weeping in Winter, How We Sleep on the Nights We Don't Make Love, The Fifth Inning, and his latest collection of poems, The Ear is an Organ Made for Love. His book, In Search of Color Everywhere, was awarded the 1994 Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Award and was a Book of the Month Club selection. Miller received the 1995 O.B. Hardison Jr. Poetry Prize. In 1997, he was presented with the Stephen Henderson Poetry Award by the African American Literature and Culture Society. His book, Fathering Words, was selected by D.C. We Read in 2003 for the One Book, One City program sponsored by the D.C. Public Libraries. In 1979, the mayor of Washington, D.C. proclaimed September 28, 1979 as E. Ethelbert Miller Day. He was awarded a Fulbright in 2003 when he traveled to Israel. His work has been widely anthologized. He is a board member of the Writers' Center and editor of Poet Lore magazine. Since 1974, he has been the director of the African American Resource Center at Howard University. Mr. Miller is the former chair of the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C., and a former core faculty member of the Bennington Writing Seminars at Bennington College. And there's a lot more that I haven't even mentioned. So welcome, Ethelbert.
Oh, great to be here.
Really happy to have you here. So I heard that you're going to read some poems for us.
Sure, I'll read three poems for you to start the program off.
Okay.
This is the title poem from The Ear is an Organ Made for Love. It was the language that left us first, the great migration of words. When people spoke, they punched each other in the mouth. There was no vocabulary for love. Women became masculine and could no longer give birth to warmth or a simple caress with their lips. Tongues were overweight from profanity and the taste of nastiness. It settled over cities like fog, smothering everything in sight. My ears begged for camouflage and the chance to go to war. Everywhere was the decay of how we sound. Someone said it reminded them of the time Sonny Rollins disappeared. People spread stories of how the ear would never be the same or forgive. It was the end of civilization, and nowhere could one hear the first notes of a love supreme. It was as if John Coltrane had never been born. And this next poem is entitled, So This Is What the Living Do. When did we begin to wear sneakers to funerals? Or sports jerseys and caps? When did things begin to die? I pass a church four blocks from the Safeway. I see the last generation of old black men in suits. These men are professionals. They touch death every day. They carry the coffin and drive the hearse. They arrange the flowers and offer comfort. They escort you into limos and tell you where to sit. They know the directions to the cemetery. What do you know? I know that I am dying. Dreams first are what you might call the lint of disappointment. It has always been this way. This knowing, the realization that I will do this alone. I once believed in love the way I believed in beauty, the living with dignity, style, and grace. I thought my shoes always needed to be polished whenever I left the house. There is a way the day ends after you pass a funeral. How you walk down the street, afraid to look over your shoulder. They say, this is what the living do. And this third poem is actually one of the last poems I've written. It's called, What Do They Do? What do torturers do when they return home? Do they make love to their wives and play with their kids? What hobbies do they have? Do they wash the car and take out the trash? Do they change their underwear? What do torturers see when they look in the refrigerator? When shopping, do they go to the front of the line? Do they get discounts on meat? Do torturers remember their anniversaries? Do they place candles on birthday cakes and blow them out? When torturers go to church, who do they pray to? When they get caught in traffic jams, do they curse the cars in front of them? Do they worry when they get dirt and blood under their fingernails? What type of deodorant do they use? When torturers leave a room, do they turn out the lights? Are they superstitious? Do they avoid stepping on sidewalk cracks? Do they read their horoscopes before going to work? How many torturers have two jobs? When lost, do they ask strangers for directions? Are they left-handed or right-handed? Do torturers sit in outdoor cafes and talk about torture? Do they suffer memory loss? Do they call in sick and say they can't report for work? How safe is a torturer's workplace? When they fall to sleep, do they snore? Do torturers keep everyone awake at night?
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet E. Ethelbert Miller, reading some new work. I can say I've never heard that those lines before. The torturers have more than two jobs.
Right. You know? Yeah, many probably do.
Yeah. And it really makes me think of what I was going to ask you, which is, you know, the relationship between activism and poetry, which we were talking about a little bit before, but it seems so integral in your work and in your speech that almost like you can't talk about poetry without talking about its work in the world, or but what are people writing about really, and what is the relationship of that to the world? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, if someone's looking at my, and you read my bio note, some part of it, you know, I happen to be a poet who for 18 years, I've sat on the board of the Institute for Policy Studies, you know, and for a number of years I've been chair of the board. I take that association and that responsibility very seriously. I'm also felt I've been blessed by many people associated with the Institute who are some fine intellectuals. You know, founded, the Institute was founded by Mark Raskin and Dick Barnett. There's no way I can walk among these individuals and not be affected by the research that they're doing. Everything from national security issues to the Middle East problems, global warming. So that's sort of like my environment, those surrounding people like I'm hanging out with. So that affects my work. I'm not right now teaching in a creative writing program. I'm not trying to hone my craft or send works out. So I'm pretty much associated to, you know, with things that are happening in the world. You know, I've been really increasing my travel the last couple of years. You know, so I'm going to various countries. You know, I just came back from, you know, Central Europe. When you see the conditions, you know, of high unemployment and things of that sort, especially among youth, when you sit down to write, these things affect you. You know, I remember, for example, last few years, the whole issue of the homelessness, you know, in our society began to penetrate my work. Not that I constantly went out to write a poem about the homeless, but what happens is that when I sat down, certain images began to penetrate my work and wound up on the page. And so I think anyone who is a writer, especially a poet, you are sensitive to things around you. Hopefully you've developed your sense of your senses, so your ability to see and touch, hear. It's very important. You know, the poem I read, for example, The Ears of Organ Made for Love, is an outgrowth of just the fact that I don't drive, and so I'm always, you know, dependent on public transportation. And after a while, I just got very tired of listening to especially young people just talking a certain way. You know, I felt that what was happening was that our language was becoming somewhat fragmented. I felt that the beauty of our language was being lost, along with the issue in terms of certain issues of ethics and morality and manners, which is almost like saying, you know, here's a formal way to write a poem. You know, there's a certain structure and stuff. And I felt that with our language, especially if we're writers, we want to make sure that we maintain a certain beauty. You know, I remember, for example, I never heard my mother use any profanity. When I heard my father use profanity, it had a certain eloquence. And you sat up and took notice and you behaved. And it sort of was used that way. Now it's, for example, I hear so much of it that my ear becomes numb. And when I looked at what I wound up doing, I would go home and I said, well, you know, how can I clean my ear out? So I started listening to like John Coltrane, and sometimes I have a really tough day. I listen to some Sun Ra or Ornette Coleman to really, you know, get that out of my ear so that I could hear better and perhaps write better poems.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because I was going to ask you about beauty initially. I was going to say, when I think of your poems, I think about beauty. And then you read the torture poem, and then I thought of a different question. But yeah, I really do associate your work with some kind of beauty. And I think part of it is your voice. You have a great voice, and it's the way you deliver it. But it's the poetry that suggests connection. A lot of times has great humanity in it. And well, what happens though as a writer when you're, you know, sitting there and having a lot of, you know, brutal images? I'm sure you don't shut those out of your work.
You don't shut those out, but you know, same way if you're dealing with your politics. You know, it's very easy to go out and protest against certain things. The question, I think, for activists is, what are you for? Okay, what do you believe in? You know, what type of vision do you have for the new society? I always go back to the fact that, and I learned this from Martin Luther King and other great political and spiritual leaders. You know, I strongly believe in the beloved community. You know, I strongly believe in terms of people coming together. I'm very much concerned about, you know, income inequality. I think when those things motivate you, and when you're giving readings, for example, I feel, for example, when I look at my work, I'm always coming back to this theme of love. I'm always bringing it. Even if they look at the torture poem, I'm raising this question. I say, okay, I look at these images, you know, in terms of newsreel, read the papers, pictures, and, you know, here's people throwing rocks, here's people blowing up stuff. Who do they go home to? You know, I mean, who wants to make love to that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what do you find in many societies? The same type of individual who's throwing a rock at somebody publicly is hitting somebody in the head in terms of in their home. So when you look at the abuse of women in some of these societies and the silence that they are forced to be suffocated with, then you realize exactly, you know, what you should be for. And the whole thing in terms of love is something that I try to bring into my work. And if we look at politics, the most difficult thing on an individual level is to love another human being. That is one of the most challenging things. I'm talking about a community.
Right, right.
I'm talking about loving one-on-one, right, okay? Mm-hmm. That is very difficult. And this is why Baldwin, great Jimmy Baldwin, it was very accurate when he looked at race relations and he said, this black-white struggle is like a lover's war.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Once you believe in that, then you realize, okay, we are going to have our ups and downs, and we have to work through it.
Okay.
And that's the challenge I think we have as writers, to make sure that we use the language as a tool to help us love better.
Okay. Could you read more, please?
You know, I know you like football, but, you know, it's just not the Steelers. The Pirates are here, and then we know what happened to that franchise. But anyway.
Well, be nice.
Be nice.
You're in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, but I can be nice because, you know, finally in Washington, D.C., we have a first-place team, you know. But this is spring training.
Okay.
This is the season your arm fails. The ball has its own dreams. The youngest player on the field could be your son. When did playing catch become work? Your wife, once a woman with curves, is showing her age. She avoids mirrors. You see yourself in her. Spring is simply a promise and a hope to make the team. A man can die on any base. You hum Precious Lord to yourself. You pray, then throw. Let me read you a poem from a collection called How We Sleep on the Nights We Don't Make Love. This year, we've seen it in terms of everyone's been into Lincoln. This year, we're getting ready for like the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg. There's been a lot of, you know, celebrations, and we had the movie Lincoln that was out And I decided I would read this poem, which is an old poem. It's called Anna Murray Douglas, Frederick Douglass's first wife. Anna Murray Douglas. I cannot read the North Star, but it shines at night in my bedroom. I hold a free man in my arms. Is it love that still keeps me a slave? What speech could he whisper in my ears that would make me listen to his heart? In the dark, does my dark skin remind him of the darkness? I cannot spell the word abolitionist. I can only read the name Frederick Douglass. I know these two words well. Many will remember the life he lived. And me, yes, they will say I was his wife before he married the white woman. And this is another poem in How We Sleep on the Nights We Don't Make Love. Nothing But a Man. Martin Luther King poem. When he turns to sleep on his side, I stare at his back and place my hand where segregation once was. If my lover is the Black Messiah, then tonight I rest his crown on my head. Martin, I whisper in the dark. Our presence in this hotel room is like a candle ready to be knocked over. Fire spreading like love. Rumors leaping to a tape recorder next door. And I'll read this poem about Houdini. I was fascinated by Houdini, and I was just in Hungary, and you know, Houdini's roots are in Hungary. And I grew up thinking, you know, I always looked at Houdini as a magician. You know, that's how I grew up. And Houdini was actually an escape artist. And so I started focusing on that. And this is called Lessons from Houdini. You practice disappearing in front of a mirror. All your wife can see is your face. Magic is how your body vanished in bed. Once you practice with knives and hats, the rabbit trick was a snap. Houdini comes back from the dead to explain how to escape from a trunk of underwater. He tells you to hide a divorce in your marriage. Learn to pick the lock. Convince yourself there are no chains. Practice holding your breath. Count the years. Surface through the pain.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet E. Ethelbert Miller, reading his poems. I wanted to ask you about continue what we're talking about, but in terms of something I hear in your poems a lot is what is passing away, and what remains, and what is new. And again, we were talking earlier about that you're focused on the now, and you have obviously a lot of ideas. Can you talk about that sort of, I don't know if you'd call it an obsession of yours, you know, what is leaving us?
Well, I tell you one thing that I started out reading the poem, Ears of the Organ Made for Love, and that poem is actually dedicated to my friend Mikkei. Mikkei has had a significant influence on my life. She's a fiction writer presently living in South Korea, but she's a member of the Bennington Writing Seminars Program. And she's a Korean adoptee. And what she was talking to me about was the whole thing of erasure, you know, where you have people, for example, who have been adopted, who are going back and finding who their birth mother was and maybe not liking their birth mother, so now they deal with erasure, which I find that very interesting as a concept. The same way today, if you were going to run or you got nominated for the Supreme Court or something like that or decided to run for office, we may erase your Facebook page or whatever, that people now wrestle with that because it seems like you can't erase anything. We're documenting everything. And I think now, because we're documenting everything, we may have to ask ourselves, what is memory? Okay. At the same time, I think the concept of erasure creates a whole new paradigm, you know, where all of a sudden, if we erase ourselves, we have the opportunity of maybe reinventing ourselves and looking at things differently. So for example, one could look at the Middle East and say, okay, here is a conflict that's definitely rooted in history. Okay, what if we just erase that, you know, and just start all over again, you know? Those are the challenges I think that we as thinkers can begin to look at things and perhaps shift the paradigm. You know, this is where I think after a while you have to make a certain leap. That leap, that space there might be a point theoretically of erasure. But I'm looking at that and I'm saying that after having written two memoirs, mm-hmm. where I was going back and I realized, you know, in terms of memoir writing, so many people are caught up into storytelling, you know, going back and documenting that. And I felt that's nice, but I was also looking at, okay, perhaps, you know, there's certain things we should just forget.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and do we suffer any more, any less because we can't remember?
Mm-hmm. Well, how does that relate to your poetry? I mean, you're spending a whole lot of time documenting, writing things down.
Well, I think what happens, first of all, I'm not memorizing my work, so that's where a lot of things get lost. Also what happens, I'm writing at a pace now where I'm not writing for publication, mm-hmm. you know, so unless somebody comes behind me, there are a lot of poems that are in my blog and stuff like that that I'm not writing to retain. Now, if somebody wants to come and document my career, they can find those poems and stuff and pull them together. I'm not at a point right now, or I'm at a point right now, I'm not thinking about, like, let me put together a book. I'm not thinking book.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
For example, your listeners, if they wanted to obtain copies of The Ears Organ Made for Love, they could just go to my website and download the whole thing for free, you know. And I did that because when I started out as a writer and as an activist, I did not get into the poetry, you know, business to make money, you know.
Well, I mean, who would, really?
Well, let's look at it. It's sort of like you bring in George Benson. I remember when George Benson, somebody said, how come you don't play jazz? You say, well, I'll play jazz. You pay me. You know, I mean, you got a lot of poets now, spoken word artists, but, you know, who want to get paid. You know what I'm saying? You know, they want to win the award, you know. And so there's that competition. I mean, if you look at some of the slam, it is competition.
Well, sure. But if you win all the awards in poetry, you still don't have enough to live on.
Sure. But you know what happened? It's the thing in terms of, am I making music for money, okay?
Right.
Am I writing for money, okay?
Okay?
I mean, what happens is if I had taken the path of going out, getting an agent and trying to get the deal and the contract, which I have many friends who do that. You know, I have some of my friends, you know, I mean, they're making a good living from their work, you
mm-hmm.
know. They still may have another job, so the writing is not the sole thing. But at the same time, they are looking at their career in which one they're making money.
Mm-hmm.
I did not do that in terms of
right.
getting into it. So now using the technology, I can say, hey, here's my work, and it's available for anybody who's interested in it.
Okay. Could you read more, please?
This is called Tender Zippers, sort of like a Gertrude Stein. I think she has tender buttons. Tender Zippers. You make me feel zip, unzip, zippery. I would love to zip you, zip with you, zip off with you, pull your zipper, zip, zip, zip down, don't zip me up, zip along with me, zip today, zip tomorrow. I want to always zip you. What's your zip code? My hand is on my zipper. Come play with my tender zipper. You make my tender zip. Zip goes my zipper. And that, I guess, is a play on words. This is a poem. I go back to Houdini. I wrote this poem. You know, Houdini was very close to his mother. I wrote this poem when my mother died, Enid Miller. And I took parts of my life, Houdini's life, and African American's life. And this is a poem called Excerpts from the Lost Diary of the Black Houdini. And this poem is written in 16 short couplets. One. What if I told you slavery was nothing but a magic trick gone wrong? Would you believe me? Two, it was during segregation that I decided to hang myself upside down, my feet pointing north and upwards, my head still in the south. Three, there is no prison I cannot escape from. I've known blackness. Four, When I was a young boy, I was a runaway. I disappeared from the plantation and then history. 5. What is the difference between escape and erasure? How many times have I changed my name? 6. The color line makes us all acrobats. I learned to pass white folks without a net. 7. The crowd applauds after each performance. When they look into their mirrors, they see me. 8. I taught Marcus Garvey the hat trick. Everyone loves a parade. 9. King tells me his dream. I consult my dream book and find a page missing. 10. My father takes me to Coney Island. He tells me all of America is an amusement park. Learn to laugh or die. 11. Fame made me a race leader. I get paid for describing misery, not magic. 12. White teeth and a big smile. I hide the key under my tongue. 13. Let me tell you about metamorphosis. It will explain why I'm there and not here. 14. Love is a pair of handcuffs. Do I want to escape? Can I? 15. My mother died yesterday afternoon. All my life, I've been trying to reach her. 16. I hold my breath and keep counting. How long can I survive underwater without love? Here's a very short poem. Revision always brings me back to love. The conversation turns to pencils and writing. You mentioned how you love to underline. I wonder what might attract you. What word might flirt or seduce you? Oh, and what about the eraser? The other end of writing? Why is there always a line drawn through my heart? And Space is the Place. That's a Sun Ra album. Space is the Place. Love is the last planet in our solar system. Your heart crying like the rings of Saturn. How can we believe in stars in this darkness? I watch the sky for your return. Inside my hands, nothing but gravity.
The poetry of E. Ethelbert Miller. Thank you so much. That was great.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Always good to be in your presence.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.